That autumn, a pack of feral dogs swept into our schoolyard, barking and keening and charging the air with an electrifying stench. Wild, festering creatures, some bald with mange, others buried in clumps of matted frizz, or hobbling on three legs, or squinting through worm-eaten eyes. Rip Driggers was on the porch of my portable classroom, cooling off after a laughing fit, and he came scrambling through the door, waving his fist and spitting, "Dogs, dogs, dogs, hundreds of them, craziest mutts you ever saw." We were into the sluggish haze of afternoon, picking at a Dickinson poem, the room smelling of sour socks. My dozing seventh graders dashed from their seats to the windows. The dogs were their salvation, mongrel hordes pouring in from strange magic parts of the earth. The animals skittered around the playground, yapping at each other, squirting piss onto swing sets, sniffing each other's piss, pissing on each other's piss, snorting at each other's anuses and snarling. They threw themselves into tangles of squealing and flew apart again. The principal emerged from the cafeteria, peered at the dogs, and then hurried back inside. A minute later, his nasal drone issued from the PA system. "A collection of stray canines has entered our playground area. Teachers and students must not leave the main building or their portable classrooms." I stood at the window watching the wild beasts prance in the sun. In less than 15 minutes, a fleet of SUVs glittered in the school's front drive. Mothers sat idling, but no one could leave the school just yet, even though the dogs had moved down to the soccer field, even though the ASPCA, the Humane Society, the police and fire departments had all been called, even though the soul-stirring, apocalyptic wails of multiple sirens announced that authority figures were speeding nigh. Suddenly, I'd found myself past 30, shacked up with a fussy, bald man 9 years my senior who enjoyed monitoring every facet of our household. Finances, thermostat, hot water heater, water and electricity, lawn maintenance, and pest control. His brain had become a grid of interlocking systems. His eyes were shrinking into beads as the years went by. He, who had once been a luminescent lover, a beautiful pale trembler with long flowing hair. I didn't know how this had happened, but now he sat by our sliding glass door, clutching his Beeman air rifle, some of his old pluck surging back as he scanned our yard for curs. The bastards, as he called them, had chewed our plastic garbage cans to shreds, had consumed every edible morsel in our trash, had strewn the remaining filth far and wide. The hunger-crazed beasts came in the night and gobbled up anything vaguely organic. The previous week, the dogs had sprayed our garage with their spicy pee and sent my husband into a tizzy. He removed every object, pressure washed the area with bleach water, and then slathered key spots with Get Serious pet odor and pheromone extractor. At night, he slid his recliner close to the sliding glass door to better keep his vigils. While consuming exactly 3 Budweisers, he had brewed in the dark with his gun, waiting for that moment when the brutes would come whirling into his floodlit territory, rearranging the molecules of the air with their yipping and fried egg stink. BB pellets did not kill the dogs, who didn't seem to remember from one day to the next that they'd been shot. But the yelp of a struck dog made my husband smile. And he, a passionate advocate for gun control, kept threatening to buy himself a serious firearm. I watched TV alone. Each night the news spouted facts about dog packs. Feral dogs, fast becoming a worldwide menace, dwelled in condemned buildings, junk car lots, sewers, and abandoned strip malls. They invaded human territory to scavenge and hunt. They killed in teams, herding livestock, cats, and rodents into corners where they tore them into bite-sized chunks. The American pet craze had led to an epidemic of abandoned dogs. A rash of dog-fighting rings had flared in rural ghettos, and the repressed wolfish instincts of domestic dogs had been coaxed out, had transmogrified into weird new breeds. The fighting champions of the packs naturally ruled over the expats, also over the bait dogs, smaller, wimpier dogs once bred to rile the fighters. You could recognize a bait dog by its shabby condition, its downtrodden vibe, and crippled state. Etched with scars, half-blind, riddled with abscesses, and often lacking a limb, it slunk and whined around the glorious snapping fighters, sinewy beasts with bear claws and yellow shark teeth. Some of the more splendid alphas had long incisors like baboons. Others had needle claws that retracted into their toe pads like those of cats. Legions of freakish specialists had stepped out of the woodwork to describe these evolutionary quirks of reverted dog species. And they, along with innumerable dog bite victims, bewildered farmers, and owners of dismembered cats, were always being interviewed on TV. My favorite dog specialist was an evolutionary ecologist who'd written his dissertation on the mating habits of wild primates that had foregone foraging to scavenge human food. And now, back in the States, Dr. Vilkas had become an expert on de-domestication. He wore army fatigues. He shot his own footage with a digital minicam. Half artist, half scientist, he looked a little wild himself, peering through unkempt black hair with an unnerving set of mismatched eyes, one blue, one green. Though an American citizen, Dr. Vilkas had a trace of an accent, trilling and growling, and the way he pronounced his Z's made me blush. He sported bite-proof arm and leg bands and drenched himself with special pheromones to keep his beloved dogs from attacking him. He skulked among them, filmed them eating and coupling and suckling their scraggly young, filmed them squealing in the throes of birth and barking with joy as they sabotaged a dumpster or disemboweled a rat. Dr. Vilkas followed dog packs as they migrated among urban dead zones, blighted farm belts, and dying towns. Our own town fit the usual profile: failing schools, rinky-dink chicken farms, and closing plants, an obese and debt-strapped populace who fed on processed food, their offspring suffering new configurations of hyperactivity disorders and social dysfunction. Dr. Vilkas gave no instructions on how to deal with the dog epidemic. He eluded authorities who solicited advice on how to hunt down and exterminate the dogs. Though he seemed to know something about the dogs' roaming and sleeping patterns, he remained tight-lipped on these subjects while talking about the social habits of the dogs, their complex hierarchies, mating strategies, and choreographed hunting tactics, their territorial urination, sensitivity to pheromones, body language, and variations of barking. When a reporter asked Dr. Vilkas how frequently pets were tempted away from domestication into wildness, the specialist warned dog owners to keep their animals secured. And though he encouraged them to invest in sturdier leashes and to read books on canine psychology so as to recognize signs of restlessness, he couldn't disguise his excitement over the thought of tame animals lured from their lives of monotonous sycophancy by the siren calls of ferals. His strange eyes shone. He gazed longingly at the horizon where a chemical plant huffed filth into the sky. Outside, the autumn afternoon swelled golden, and the children squirmed in their desks. They looked grubby, their clothes rumpled, their hair greasy. I assume their parents were distracted by the dog epidemic. Everyone was. Because the students gabbled of nothing else, most of the teachers had given in to their obsession. We designed dog-themed lesson plans. The principal arranged for specialists to speak in the auditorium. Some even made classroom visits. Now in my English class, a warm miasma of boredom settled on my students. Eyelids fluttered, heads drooped. The restless among them jogged their knees, tapped their pencils, and glanced towards windows. Tammy Harley swatted the air in front of her frown, said that Bobby Baines had cut one. A sly smile smoldered on Bobby's freckled face. Poor little Bobby, whose father hosed down the gut room at the poultry plant with scalding bleach water. And then three football players blasted long farts, timing their stunt with hand signals. Children covered their noses. They gasped and pretended to faint. Several cheerleaders scrambled from their seats to the air conditioning vent, stood panting over it, screaming, "Pigs!" My heart beat faster. I shivered. I felt a tingling sensation in my spine. Suddenly, I could detect the salty, rank smell of dogs, and I wondered if some of the animals had been sleeping under my portable classroom. Seconds later, Tanya Gooding spotted a dog pack leaping from the trash-strewn cops that separated our schoolyard from a Burger King parking lot. splitting the day wide open with barking and feral verve. "Damn," she cried, "it looks like they're flying." Though I motioned for the kids to keep their rears glued to their seats, all but Jebediah Jinx, a preteen preacher with 11 siblings, flew to the windows. I took my usual station at the door, sniffing what was now almost palpable in the air. "Does anybody smell that?" I asked my students. "Smell what?" said Tanya Gooding. And as dead flies give perfume a bad smell, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and humor, Jebediah preached from his desk. A sign of the end times, a plague like frogs or locusts, except only with dogs, or like them swine Jesus put the demons in. We got war, we got AIDS and hurricanes, we got terrorists and obesity and homosexuality and dogs. Do you think God's trying to tell us something? The other kids just tittered, and the dogs came romping and snarling, tussling and woofing, mongrels big as panthers and little as squirrels, balding curs with skin like burnt cheese, mutts with lion's manes, canines with dreadlocks matted over their eyes. Short dogs waddled on stumpy legs, tall dogs loped like spooked gazelles, and the big rangy fighters led the pack, nipping their inferiors. Then I saw Dr. Vilka sprinting from the woodlet after the pack, camera hoisted, lank hair streaming. My heart lurched, my ears burned. I stepped out onto the porch and locked the children inside. I could barely hear their muffled screams, so loud was the clamor of dogs. The air smelled of Fritos and urine. Hot winds blew, as though the mongrels had brought their own weather. I gripped the railing and watched Dr. Vilkas creep up on a skirmish between two alphas. In the middle of the playground, two gape-mouthed fighters were hurling themselves at each other, a liver-colored pit bull against a spotted mastiff, for however you say that. I could hear the clack of their teeth. The dogs growled, retreated, and flew together again, lifting a cloud of orange dusk. Dr. Vilkas stood 2 yards from them, squinting into his camera. When the dust cloud dispersed, the triumphant pit bull was dancing around the fallen mastiff. But then the creature stopped cold, sniffed the wind, and looked right at me. As though fired from a cannon, it flew toward my portable, leapt over a stunted juniper, and landed in the sad little place right below my porch where my children had spit 1,000 loogies. The dog snarled at me. When it opened its rank maw, I gasped at the sight of its jumbled teeth. Its slimy bug eyes watched me. Breath flowed from the beast in thick wheezes. The animal growled. I fingered the keys in my pocket, backing toward the door. The children, watching the spectacle from within, yelled and pounded on the windows, and Dr. Vilkas scrambled toward me, holding some object in both hands, his camera, I thought, figuring he'd film my disembowelment. I dropped my keys, heard them clatter against the wooden porch and bounce onto the ground. The pit bull's neck hackles shot up. Its gums quivered. The creature sprang 3 feet into the air, then fell on its side, flopped around in the dust, and rolled into a motionless heap. "You okay?" Dr. Vilkas stood beside the dog. "Did you kill it?" "Stunned it with a portable electrode dart." Dr. Vilkas waved his newfangled aluminum gun. "The animal will revive in 5 to 10 minutes. "I'm glad you didn't kill it." "Really?" He smiled. "You know it's illegal to shoot them with real guns." "I know. Actually, someone I know bought a tranquilizer gun." Dr. Vilkas fixed me with his mismatched eyes. His gaunt cheeks were scruffed with faint stubble. He had a beautiful mouth, wide and full. He stooped to pluck my keys from the ground. Sirens took the air again, and the dog started howling. The pack scrambled east as though fleeing the sun. The fallen pit bull let out a little croak and twitched its hind legs. "Better get inside your classroom," said Dr. Vilkas, "before this beast revives." I slipped back into my portable where the children had turned off the lights to see better. They cheered for me. Girls pressed in to hug me, wet-eyed, smelling of French fries and imitation designer perfumes. I found my husband on the back stoop, hunched over his new tranquilizer gun, 3 beer cans methodically crushed and stacked at his feet, ready to be boxed and hauled to the scrap metal recycling center. "You're almost an hour late," he said. "Emergency meeting," I said. "The dogs came back to school today." For some reason, this made my husband frown. "I needed you here. I wanted to run through the drill." "Drill? With the cages, remember, we've got to get the fallen dogs into the cages within 20 minutes. That's how long the tranquilizer darts last, on average. And for some of the larger species, who knows what our window will be. Why don't we run through it now? Because it's dusk. The dogs always show up at dusk or else after midnight. Haven't you noticed that? My husband was sporting hunting chaps. He wore his new Hex Armor bite-proof gloves purchased on the web from a veterinarian supply emporium. He had also bought a pair of dog-kicking boots with treads for running and steel toes, and I'd seen him practicing, kicking logs, smashing the snouts of invisible monsters. But now he slumped on the bottom step, all dressed up for our drill, and I'd stood him up. I patted his scalp. I sniffed the air for whiffs of wild dog. My husband, perpetually congested from allergies, could never smell any animals coming, the animals coming, could never sense the bustle in the air, the electromagnetic hullabaloo that made my spine buzz and brought a pleasant fizzle of panic to my heart. Even before the dogs tumbled into my field of vision like a promise kept, "The dogs won't come tonight," I said. "How do you know that?" Feminine intuition, whatever. I think I may have a more developed vomeronasal organ than you do. I smiled as I said this, but I half believed it. What the fuck is that? Pheromone detector, a throwback organ maybe, deep in the nose. Some people had sensitive ones, moist and throbbing and bristling with neurons, while other people's were all dried up, almost non-existent. I opened the sliding glass door. It's like half the population has lost its sense of smell. The air conditioner's on, you know. I closed the sliding glass door. I went to check my email. There was a message from our principal with an attachment that contained a list of experts willing to make classroom visits. I scrolled to the bottom of the page where I discovered the email address of Dr. Ivan Vilkas, evolutionary ecologist and forerunner in the burgeoning field of de-domestication. Dr. Vilkas was scheduled to visit my world history class. My students fidgeted and fussed. Whispery agitation erupted in problem areas. Gobs of slobbered paper flew from certain mouths, smacked against the cheeks of certain targets. It was a hot, muggy day, our air conditioning system on the blink, and the children sweat smelled peculiar, as though spiked with new combinations of minerals. Their lips looked redder than usual. Most of the kids needed haircuts. We were discussing an archaeological excavation in Iran, where a tomb containing both human and canine remains had been discovered, the dog skeleton curled in a jar, the man buried with daggers and arrowheads. And I'm going to skip this little conversation that they have about that. Just as it began to rain, Dr. Vilkas arrived, his knock quick against my hollow aluminum door. I found him grinning on my little porch, spattered with drops, clutching his laptop and a tangle of cables. "PowerPoint presentation," he said, tapping his computer. "It's that guy," said Rufus Teed. "I saw you on television," said Tanya Gooding. We had 35 minutes left until the class ended and my planning period began, so we hustled to get his laptop hooked up to my digital projector. As we searched for the right cable, rain beat against the flat tar roof of my ancient portable. The children murmured and sniggered and pinched each other. Cryptic underground smells oozed up from the vents. Dr. Vilkas asked me to cut the lights, and I stood in the humming darkness with my arms crossed over my breasts. "Well, now," he said, flashing his first side, a diagram of the canine nasal system. "We don't have much time, so I'm going to jump right in." Dr. Vilkas rubbed his palms together and smiled at the students, his chin receding. "While the human nose contains about 5 million scent receptors," he began, "the average dog snout boasts over 200 million. After pausing to let the drama of his opener sink in, he launched an incomprehensible lecture describing the receptor neurons and olfactory epithelium of the vomeronasal organ, its dark, squishy, fluid-filled sacs, its mucus-slaked cellular microvilli, which absorbed innumerable odor molecules. As he descended deeper into thickets of technical jargon, his sentences became endless, his accent heavier. The children couldn't take their eyes off of him. One by one, their mouths popped open. They sat stock still in their cramped desks. By the time the bell rang, Dr. Vilkas had not progressed past his first slide. Rather than darting from their chairs, the students filed out slowly, glancing back at the evolutionary ecologist before slumping out into the drizzle. We stood alone in the dark room. "I had a film I wanted to show them," Dr. Vilkas said. "That's too bad," I said. "I would have loved to see it." "Well, you could. I mean, we could watch it right now if you're free." The classroom smelled pungent with a trace of something coppery I could almost taste. Who knew what chaos of desperate pheromonal signals my poor caged students pumped out day after day in our dank little portable as the beauties of the world glimmered beyond their reach in the mythical places they watched on screens. We sat in their tiny desks toward the back of the room in the territory of the football players, where a turbulent energy still seemed to hover. The film, a montage of hundreds of individual canines caught in the act of sniffing, had no sound. We watched one silent dog after another thrust its snout toward this or that reeking object. We saw them snorting hectically at each other's genitals. Male dogs patrolled invisible borders, adding their own messages to the mix. Female dogs snuffled their fragrant nurslings. Old dogs nosed their bodies all over for signs of doom. Halfway into the film, Dr. Vilka started talking about the different kinds of pheromones, territorial scent markers creating boundaries, alarm pheromones warning of looming dangers, male sex pheromones conveying the special genotype of each species, female sex pheromones announcing optimum fertility, and then there were comfort pheromones released by nursing females to calm their worried young. "The world is a tempestuous tangle of significant odors," said Dr. Vilkas, "and humans are blunt-nosed fools." "Is it possible for us to pick up some of the dog's messages?" I asked him, without knowing what we're picking up. "We don't really understand the human vomeronasal organ," he said. By the way, my editor changed the spelling of that word, I noticed, so I keep stumbling over it. Not you, the other editor, but anyway. Scientists are just beginning to understand a little about human pheromones, how they give us very particular impressions about each other. The film ended and the room went dim, gray storm air glowing outside the windows. "Sometimes," I said, "before a dog pack appears here at school or at my house, I get this special tingling feeling." "Where?" "I don't know, in my brain, my spine, the nervous system, I guess. I don't know if I really smell anything at this point." "Very interesting," he said, rising from his desk. "I have an appointment, but I'd like to talk more about this phenomenon. We could, I don't know, meet somewhere? Yes, we could do that." Dr. Vilkas walked to the media cart and closed his laptop. "Like for coffee, maybe," I rasped. "Or maybe we could conduct some tests, scientific experiments with the dogs." Dr. Vilkas dropped one of his cables and picked it up, put it down on the media cart, shook my hand with his hot hand, tucked his laptop under his army jacket, and walked out into the rain. "Late again," said my husband, who held a baggie of fetid meat in his hand, bait for the new leg hold traps he'd positioned in shallow trenches around the yard. We were standing behind the garage beside our new aluminum garbage cans, a hot spot for canine activity. "The dogs," I said. "Did they come to school today?" he asked. "No, but we had another meeting, working out the kinks of certain safety procedures." "What kind of safety procedures?" "Rabies prevention." "I thought you were going to help me install the electric fence." "An electric fence won't keep them out." "How do you know that? Intuition?" "No, actually a dog expert who spoke at school said so." Suddenly, I felt very alert. Wind blustered through the trees, shaking drops from leaves. Something zinged up my spine. I thought I smelled Fritos. "I know you think I'm crazy, but I feel like they're coming," I said. "I really do." "It's too early. They always come at dusk. At school, they usually come in the afternoon. I'm going inside." I was jogging toward our house. The mist felt good on my skin. I thought I heard my husband laughing at me. Maybe I heard a braying dog. By the time I reached the back porch, they were already streaming into our yard. My husband yelled, ran around the side of the garage, scrambled into the closet where he kept his power tools, and shut the door. He was safe, so I could laugh triumphantly on our back steps, 1 foot from the door but still outside in the electromagnetic air, my head thrown back, neck muscles rippling, a long liquid howl shooting out of my throat. The dogs didn't plunder or linger, but tumbled right through, a stinking river of fur and clamor that flowed around our side yard, dipped down into the gulch that had been cleared for a vinyl-sided mini McMansion, and disappeared. I couldn't tell whether they'd gone west or east, and with my heart still thudding, I ran inside to email Dr. Vilkas. A fluid progression, said Dr. Vilkas. Yes, beginning at the crown, dropping to the top of my neck, moving down my spine, and then, well, you know, to the pubic bone, and a quivering in between. In between? Dr. Vilkas was smirking. I'm not sure if he believed me, and perhaps I did exaggerate, but he was also tipsy, slurping exotic liquid from something called a scorpion bowl. Gin, rum, vodka, grenadine, orange, and pineapple juice. A drink that had arrived with a flaming crouton afloat in the middle of it, making him giggle and rub his palms together. There was a straw for each of us, and I'd taken more than a few nervous sips. We sat alone, deep in the interior of the Imperial Dragon, a strip mall restaurant with several windowless rooms, the inner room a jungle of plastic vines with two golden bulldogs cavorting by a miniature waterfall. We dined in a gilded gazebo. Dr. Vilkas tore a chicken wing apart and gnawed gristle from bones. The way he hunched over his food reminded me of a praying mantis, his face an uncanny blend of ugly and beautiful. He had long eyelashes and greenish temple veins, soft lips and sunken cheeks, and then there were his eyes, one a crisp arctic blue, the other a woodsy green burning above his receding chin. It could be a reaction to the overwhelming flurry of pheromones the dogs put out. Have you always been this sensitive? Sort of, but this is different, like something in my brain's open up. Is there any chance you're pregnant? For some reason, in this red-lit, windowless room, with Dr. Vilkas' head hovering 2 feet from mine, the word pregnant applied to my own body, evoking my invisible husband, uttered with a guttural dip toward the words heavy, eggy, letter G, brought a hectic flush to my face. I wondered if Dr. Vilkas would have asked this question in a business-like bustle of a coffee shop or at school in the fluorescent brightness of my portable. No, I mumbled. I mean, probably not, though I guess it's not impossible. My cheeks felt hot. I vaguely remembered having sex with my husband once in the last month, late one night on the couch, struggling to concentrate, fidgeting to achieve a comfortable position. I don't mean to pry into your private life, but pregnancy would explain an intensification of olfactory perception. Dr. Vilkas smirked again. He smiled at the oddest times, undercutting the professionalism of his words. I imagined him scrawny and naked, moving toward me with the purple heat of his erection, his chest narrow, hairless except for a few wisps around his nipples, his thighs shaggy, his fingers splayed to clamp my shoulders to hold me steady for a proper mount. I saw myself drawing my knees up. I could smell the bleach in the motel sheet, and there would be other smells, intimate and bodily, pumped from his glands and blending with the odors of feral dog. His breath would also have an odor, a mix of food and toothpaste and the health of his mouth, bacterial colonies, his tongues and gums seething with organisms, infinitesimal animals bursting with a drive to swarm. The room would reek of his equipment, plus the ghostly effluvia of inhabitants past. His wallet on the nightstand, his underwear on the floor. I've got to go, I said, pulling cash from my purse, stacking it in front of me, wrinkled and grubby with the sweat of a million human hands. What? Said my husband, for I had kissed him on the mouth. I had probed with my tongue until tasting the animal depths of him, hoping to pull this part of him out into the waning day. But he fiddled with his electric fence, which had a short, and I was tipsy, my heart getting ahead of itself, red leaves fluttering adown from the maple trees. You've been drinking, he said. Just a cocktail, I said, with a few of the teachers after the workshop. But look at me now, I'm home. I was pacing in little circles around him. And we should do something, I said. Go somewhere, maybe. Where? I don't know. A walk? What about the dogs? Take your stun gun. That would be fun. I don't feel like it, he said. I'm kind of involved with this, and it's about to get dark. He turned back to the manual that had come with his electric fence system. The next week, a cold front came, and my students arrived bundled, their winter things musty from summer storage, their eyes lit with the false promise of different weather. The old heat pump groaned, smells of dust floated up from the vents. The children were squirmy, and my mind kept going blank. The words on the pages of my books would blur, and I would squint up at the children's faces, forgetting why I was confined with so many restless young mammals. Each day I turned off the lights, I showed them films about dogs, Benji, Lassie, Cujo, making their minds converge into a single entity. I saved Cujo for after lunch, the most difficult period, and it seemed that the reign of terror held by the crazed, slobbering dog would never end, and that Cujo had always ruled the endless afternoon with his fury and red, snapping mouth. But then by 2 o'clock on Friday, the dog lay dead. His exhausted hostages were finally crawling from their dusty Ford Pinto into the harsh summer sun. My students were finally filing out into the cold, bright day, and Dr. Vilkas was finally standing outside of my portable, hunched in his army jacket, his face freshly shaven and vulnerable, looking like the skin of a baby mouse. "I called you," he said. "Oh, yeah, we were, installing an electric fence all week." "About the experiment, of course." "Experiment? Oh, your pre-olfactory neurological sensations and detection of canine activity." "Right. Whenever you're free, we could set something up." "People tend to romanticize so-called wildness," said Dr. Vilkas, who did not drink so much as open his mouth and splash wine down into his dark, gurgling throat. "So when a dog joins a feral pack, it does not in any sense break free. It simply exchanges one set of rules for another." "Yes," I said, sipping my wine carefully. I could feel dark vapors dancing up from what was probably the reptilian part of my brain. We were in his room at the Hampton Inn, the butter yellow curtains drawn, sitting at a little breakfast table beside the window in a cone of lamplight, two beds floating in the darkness beyond, one of them rumpled, the other pristine. The vinegary smell of our sub sandwiches hung in the air, and I thought I could detect a faint sulfuric whiff of dog lurking beneath the food odors and the sick, fruity tang of an air freshener. Dr. Vilkas insisted that a few drinks sharpened his intuition and that a little wine helped him think about the dogs in refreshing new ways, and that sometimes, on certain evenings, when his brain chemistry conspired to make his head glow, he could figure out the whereabouts of one of the largest feral packs. This is all he would reveal about his dog tracking techniques. When I pressed him, he answered me with his trademark smirk. He twiddled his thumbs in a way I imagine would become annoying to someone who knew his tics. He tossed more wine into his maw, and then, padding around me in his stocking feet, smelling of wet wool and wine and the deeper animal brine of armpits, he applied wireless electrodes, metal sensors the size of fleas, to my scalp, sifting through my hair with his fingers. He put on his boots. He sipped the last of his wine and smiled. Wearing my EEG helmet, I followed him out into the night. Big bright moon, sweater weather, a single cricket chirring in the shrubs. He cleared a spot for me on the seat of his Jeep, brushing crumpled Hardee's bags to the floor. Okay, so they go around looking for the dogs, and there's a scene, so I'm going to skip forward to when they finally reach an abandoned target. So beyond a cluster of gas stations out near an interstate exit, an abandoned target was sinking to ruin. Dr. Vilkas said that dogs sometimes took shelter there, but it was too dangerous to venture inside. He had a bottle of Merlot in his backpack, and we sat in the parking lot, a weedy void of crumbling asphalt, its pole lights long dead. We drank in the moonlight, passing the wine between us, listening for the yip and stir of canines. We watched the sky for the flutter of bats, pointing in silence when they dipped jaggedly into our sight. Dr. Vilkas whispered of the mysteries of echolocation. He told me that dolphins and whales use the same biological sonar, drifting in the deep sea gloom, clicking at high frequencies, their pulses penetrating the delicate anatomies of fish. And certain birds that lived in caves could navigate the blackness of intricate chasms. Dr. Vilkas handed me the bottle. His fingertips grazed my palm. He gazed at his laptop. "Detecting faint activity," he said, "perhaps in my nucleus accumbens." I felt a vague prickling of the spine, heat in my cheeks, and Dr. Vilkas said that my cingulate gyrus seemed to be stimulated, that my orbitofrontal cortex was showing signs of activity. I felt wind on my face. A bubble of warmth moved down my spine, bouncing from vertebra to vertebra. And there's this salty smell, I whispered. Don't you smell that? It's like corn chips. Dr. Vilkas didn't answer. We both stood up. We knew the dogs were coming, and we smiled at each other when they materialized in a rush, pouring around the left side of the building, their barks blurring into a single smear of sound. Do they see us? I asked him, my mouth dipping close to his ear. Yes, he leaned towards me, though they smelled us first, but the DAP spray should keep them from attacking. As the dogs, they sprayed this dog-appeasing pheromone on their bodies. I think that was in a portion that I skipped. As the dogs raced around the edges of the parking lot, circling us, sniffing out the borders of this territory, I felt a delicious terror. I took two steps forward and glanced back at Dr. Vilkas, who hung behind, grinning at the diagram of my mind. My feelings lit up, garish in yellow and red. Your brain's really pulsing, he seemed to shout, though I couldn't be sure, for the dogs were pressing in on me, stink and noise and wind merging into a single whirl of sensation, their heat humming against my skin. Fur floated in the air above their spastic bodies, drifted into my nostrils, tickling mucous membranes. I sensed the hot blasts of their panting, the throbbing of 200 hearts, the clatter of 4,000 toenails. I felt their tongues, pimply tentacles smelling of death, sliding over the flesh of my hands. And now Dr. Vilkas was moving toward me through the canine sea, waist deep in fur and slaver and stink, his shirt unbuttoned, hair kinetic from the wind the dog pack whipped up. He bobbed along toward me until, hurled at my feet, he squatted on the crumbling asphalt. Tongue lolling, he panted. Squatting, grinning, he winked at me, and then he threw his head back and howled, Adam's apple pulsing, until the dogs joined in. Sitting on their haunches, every last animal found a patch of territory on which to squat and bay. They pointed their elegant snouts toward the moon, yowled, and keened and squalled until the air smelled marshy from their breath.